Coming up on Across the Chains, can ChatGPT audit smart contracts effectively? While the intersection of AI and crypto was always bound to become a thing, but is this the first crossover point? We'll discuss with guest Joe Von Loon of Auditware. Plus, BRC20s nearly crushed Bitcoin to death. The chain slows to a crawl. Is this the end of Bitcoin? And Wyoming plans its own stablecoin. Can this succeed? All this and more coming up on Across the Chains. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Hello, Sir Locky.
Hello, hello. Hello, I loved it. I loved that intro.
You like that intro? That was pretty good.
That was great.
Maybe a little over the top. Is this the end of Bitcoin?
Is this the end of Batman? that tone. I listened to a handful of football podcasts, and one of my favorite intros. He does his style of voice like that. It is wonderful. It's good memories. Well done.
Thank you, man. And hello, Joe Von Loon of Auditware. Welcome to the show, sir. Thank you so much for being here. So let me set the stage a little bit for the topic. I want to dive right in. So I've personally been really fascinated with things like ChatGPT. I've been playing around a lot with that, like all of us probably. But specifically, how AI and crypto was going to intersect, right? And the thought that I had, and others have expressed this, is that crypto is the only form of money that an AI can directly touch, right? So it's very sort of native to how an AI functions. And we haven't really seen people do much with that just yet. But we have seen ChatGPT actually write code. So and that was kind of one of the more amazing things. There's a story of a guy who typed in what Flappy Bird was, like described the game to ChatGPT, and it wrote the code and fully replicated Flappy Bird. And I guess he probably needed to tweak and do a few things along the way. So it wasn't exactly just like the computer did everything, but the computer, you know, ChatGPT did 90% of it. So we know these things can code. We know they can analyze spreadsheets. And so smart contracts seems like the first great integration point for AI and crypto. And Auditware, as I understand it, is effectively ChatGPT performs smart contract audits. But let's ask Joe. Joe, tell us, what is Auditware, and how do I have it right or not?
Yeah, thanks. So at Auditware, what we're building is called Audit Wizard. It's our like all-in-one tool for securing smart contracts. And essentially there's your tweet. So you can see our product there.
Yeah, let me get you a better view of it. Oh, hang on.
The way that AI intersects with it is we use AI more as a suggestive tool for the user, right? To kind of guide them on the right path, rather than saying AI can find vulnerabilities for you or can secure your contract for you, right? I think the tagline of this podcast episode is, can ChatGPT audit your code for you? And for us, the answer to that is no. But it's still a very good tool for helping you audit your own code, right? It does a good job of understanding code. It can write basic code, right? It can help you write tools. It can help you understand the code you're looking at. We don't think it's there yet where it can look at a smart contract and it can tell you, here's all the things wrong with it, maybe in the future, but there's definitely a long ways to go there. So what we're doing is we're starting with those first steps of, what is ChatGPT? What is GPT-4 good for? Let's bring those tools to the auditors and start using them.
So basically, what you're describing, Jason Calcanis was talking about AI on This Week in Startups recently, and he had what I thought was a really interesting point, where there were a lot of people talking about sort of man versus machine. You know, are the AIs going to take jobs away from programmers and people? And his point was, after talking to a lot of these folks, was that the AI is more like an Iron Man suit, right? So it's not man versus machine, it's man and machine. And whoever the man in the machine is a 10x engineer, right? Effectively, all yeah. And so is that how you see it as well?
Yeah, you can think of the best way to use AI is there's a lot of like kind of boilerplate things you have to do. There's a lot of like minutiae, right? In any work, right? Anyone who's used GitHub Copilot knows they can just write out like some basic pseudocode or a comment, and then AI can just write the whole thing for them, right? And so AI ends up being a nice shortcut to a lot of things you have to do. And it's a nice shortcut to writing things you have to write, to understanding things. It has its limitations, but you know, if you use it as an extension of yourself, you can take those shortcuts and you can just focus on kind of the high level. So if you think of AI kind of like someone working under you as this kind of AI agent employee almost, right? You just give it a few basic instructions and it will go and do those things. It can be very powerful.
So tell me how exactly, can you give me a better description of exactly how ChatGPT works within your product? I read the descriptions and it says, yep, you scan static code, you scan with tools called Slither and Mithril, which I don't know what those, yep, things are. Souvlaki might, I don't. You don't either. Okay. So these are apparently code analysis tools,
yep,
and analyze the code for threats and vulnerabilities with AI powered by GPT-3. Can you give us a little bit more detail on what's happening there under the hood?
Yeah. I'll start off by saying our product is in kind of like an alpha stage right now. I'd invite anyone to go kind of check it out, see what we're doing and play around with it. We'll have a beta coming in the next 3 months or so. But to your question on precisely what the AI is doing, so we're starting by taking what ChatGPT is really good at, reading some code and kind of telling you in human readable terms what's going on, right? So we kind of have that built in. The next step is, you know, in addition to the static code analysis tools like Slither and Mithril, basically what they do is they break down the code into kind of like a high order flow, like what's going on within the code, and then they can apply rule sets to that. You know, is there a reentrancy here based on some sort of pattern that I'm seeing? We can do sort of the same thing with AI if we can break down the code to AI in such a way where it can kind of understand the flows of things. We can take it a step further than just understanding the code, understanding the semantics, or doing some pattern matching like any other static code analysis tool. We can actually have it suggest things to you. Like, it looks like this code is an ERC-20 contract and it does these things. So then, and then we take the AI and we have it go a step further and say, okay, it's doing those things. What are some security threats that might be present, right? If it says you're using an Oracle, you know, in our tool, it will present to you, here's all the things related to oracles that you're going to be concerned about. So you as an auditor in the tool, the AI kind of feeds you these ideas of things to chase down, things to look at. And then, you know, as I said before, it has this kind of shortcut value where if you think you found something, the AI, you know, you have to write a report as an auditor. And you can say, okay, I think this code is vulnerable for these reasons. You might just write a basic note. AI will fill in all the blanks, put that into a report for you. So really using it as this sort of suggestive engine, but then also kind of a shortcut to doing your work so you can just focus on the high level stuff.
But you would have to be an engineer to understand the feedback that it's giving you, right? Like, you know, you say something like, oh, there's some reentrancy. Like a regular person is not going to know what that means, right? So you have to be an engineer to interpret what's coming out of the AI. So again, it's an Iron Man suit, right? But the engineer can be like, oh my God, I didn't see that. I would have never thought of that or whatever. And can quickly address it, you know, maybe using ChatGPT to do it. So Souvlaki, what do you think about all this so far?
I think it's quite interesting. Joe, I'm not sure if I get something that maybe is coming in later versions, but I saw recently, actually a couple of days ago, LIDAR released some of, like, they audit for, they do audits from time to time, and they did nine audit. They got nine different audit companies to look at their code around staked ETH. And the interesting thing around those audit reports is they don't all bring out the same thing. And some audit firms mark like a topic as critical, some as high, some as medium. In terms of like the AI, the assistance that it gives you, like who ultimately decides? If you ask it for, you know, is there a potential vulnerability in this area, that classification between critical, high, medium, low, is it you, the engineer working with it, that does the classification, or does the AI guide you along that step?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to give an AI such an assignment that even people can't agree on. And this is actually a big problem in the security engineering space. Even in the Web2 world, which I worked in for about 8 years as a security engineer, no one can agree on the severity of anything, right? And we've seen this with platforms like Immunify, where an auditor finds a bug, and then the project owners disagree. There's contention, right? So it's actually a really hard problem to solve. What is the severity of something? And that's because the problem isn't well defined, right? And I think AI kind of struggles to solve problems that are not so well defined and help you bucket things. So with everything else in our tool, it's really just more of a suggestion, and it's up to the user to kind of define where they're going to land on that. But also something we're looking to do in our tool is provide that kind of baseline guidance of, here's the standard of rating the severity of a security vulnerability. So maybe we can provide tools for people to do their work in a similar way and come to conclusions in a similar way. And thus we can have this like framework for everyone to compare their, you know, security severities, and maybe we can finally agree on what actually constitutes a critical versus a high.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so the other big question I had looking through your stuff, so the way I understand ChatGPT and all these LLM AIs is they effectively ingest a giant amount of data, a corpus of data from the internet, and then the neural net is trained on that corpus, and then basically when it spits out an answer to something, if it's English, it spits out a sentence, a word at a time, predicting with probabilities what the probable next word is based on how its neural net is trained, right? So that suggests, yeah. And just in ChatGPT famously is stuck in November of 2021. Like it doesn't know anything that happened after that date. So security is definitely a very real-time kind of field, right? Where you have new exploits coming out all the time. It would seem that training a neural net in real time to keep up with those kinds of exploits, it's not really how it's geared, right? It's geared for sort of slow ingestion. So how do those two things square up in your mind with your product?
Yeah, so that's why our approach is that you can't really have an effective AI that's going to find vulnerabilities, right? Until we get closer to sort of like an AGI, it's really hard to have an AI that's as effective as a human at security engineering, right? You have to stay up to date on the latest news. You have to understand the threats. And also, you know, you have to do your own like deep dive and digging on what could go wrong and questioning things that are, you know, set in stone, right? That's how new vulnerabilities are found. And new vulnerabilities are found all the time through audits, right? With people like digging deep and really focusing on it. So we're taking the approach of, first of all, in a platform, you can kind of continuously train your AI model and tweak it and tune it. But also, if you take a step back from just lasering in on vulnerabilities, what's above that is thinking about what possible things could go wrong in a smart contract, like what threats there are against the contract. And then you as an auditor kind of evaluate if those threats materialize in the form of a vulnerability, right? Like could a potential attacker steal private keys or steal enough private keys from a multi-sig, if they're not handled properly or something? That's a threat. And then you could go in and you could see how the private keys are handled and then verify if there's a vulnerability there or not. So it's really hard to have an AI well tuned and well trained to make those kind of concrete verifications, but it's a simpler problem to have an AI point out what could possibly be a threat, right? And I think for that, the data set that you need is a little bit more ambiguous, and you don't have to keep up to date as much, because threats in general are more, you look at a service or an application and you think of what's everything that could break in it, right? Like that doesn't really change much over time. So that's kind of our approach of training an AI to be really good at doing that and then building on top of that. So you always need kind of the human to then take the next step of, okay, is that materialized? Is that an actual vulnerability or not?
So in the past, when I've done smart contracts, not myself, but I had a CTO I worked with who did it. And that CTO would go and purchase services, auditing services from another company. And you had to do it. Like there's no way you can issue a smart contract and not do an audit. That's just not an option. And, you know, but as the CEO of that company, I look at it, it's a big expense, right? They were actually, the audits were pretty expensive. And, you know, and every time we released a new smart contract, you have to redo the audit, right? So the expenses can pile up quite fast. I understand that your product doesn't actually do the smart contract audit for you, so you don't get rid of that expense entirely. But I would assume that it mitigates it, perhaps to a degree. Have you figured out? Have you released how are you going to price your product yet?
Yeah, I mean, our core product's always going to be free. It's kind of a freemium model. There's like some premium features for, you know, more of a power user that people will definitely want to use. But also, it's not a very expensive product either. You know, pricing isn't exactly defined now, but it won't really be, definitely not as much as getting an audit, right? And there is a lot of value we see in it for developers to kind of secure as they go. And the nice thing about that is, you know, if you use our product while you're building, you know, you're kind of catching the low-hanging fruit. You're making sure that you have the insights into security, that you design something that's secure so you don't have to make big changes later, but also so that when you go and get your audit, the auditor doesn't find a whole bunch of small things and say, okay, I'm done. Here's my report. I found enough to be kind of satisfactory. And audits, you know, as we've seen, kind of they end up being kind of an efficiency game for these firms, right? If they found enough to satisfy a client, they'll probably stop. So you can think of if you've done that groundwork for them, you kind of challenge them and, you know, they're not going to be able to find low hanging fruit, report that, turn it in. They're going to have a harder time. Also, you know, that stuff won't be in their way and they'll be able to spend more time on kind of the higher level important things. So you're not bogging them down with kind of the, you know, little nitpicky things. But also in the meantime, you know, you have at least some level of security while you wait 6 months to get your audit. You can have like a beta out there or something that, you know, it at least isn't going to have a basic reentrancy bug.
Joe, that actually makes you, we were speaking, I think it was last week. What we often find is that, you know, you do an audit now and your audit can be as complete as possible, but then things evolve and a year down the line, 6 months down the line, a new bug or not bug, a vulnerability is discovered and then contracts can get exploited. The one that we're speaking about last week was, I think it was 3 years, like the year in V1 vaults got recently, a vulnerability got discovered. Now with audit, wait, what does that create the option that, you know, if as part of the paid service, if I feed the code into it, does it, as the, I guess it's database updates, will it be able to then let me know that, hey, with the latest update, we've discovered a new vulnerability in your code, check it out. I have no idea what the technical implications are to implement that. But as a customer, like, I think that would be really cool to get those, like just an email update being like, we've pushed out this new version. You might have this issue. Please take a closer look.
Yeah. There's definitely services like that exist that kind of continuously monitor your contracts and they look for, you know, known vulnerabilities and they scan for those signatures. That's not something we do right now. That's definitely something that will be there in the future where it's kind of a more, you know, a little bit of everything that you need security wise. Like we focus on everything up till when you launch and like building your product. But after that, we don't really have much monitoring in place. We do have some partnerships with some kind of monitoring services that do that kind of stuff, though. So we're looking to have that integrated into our product for sure.
Now, you've actually done some brand name customers. Some brand name customers have used your product. On your website, it says that Slingshot and Unstoppable domains have used your product. Is that correct?
They're not using the product, but they are customers that we've done audits for.
Ah, okay. So you hand audited them. They have not used Auditware the product. Got it. But just, you know, to say that you have some street cred, you know what you're doing with audits. Bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been a security engineer for the past 8 years. My last job was at Apple on their crypto team. So I bring a lot of experience, you know, doing security reviews and things like that.
Yeah, got it. You guys are hardcore security people. Got it. Okay. So the other question I have is, you know, you get this Iron Man suit and it's really great. You have to be an engineer to use it. And we've talked a lot about it turning engineers, all of them, into 10X engineers. But what about the 10X Lex Luthor? What about the 10X hacker using these tools in the other direction to discover new exploits that, you know, a regular Lex Luthor wouldn't find? But 10X Lex Luthor now has this arsenal of AI weaponry at their disposal. How does that change the landscape in your mind?
That's the really scary thing, man. I think you said it in a previous podcast. It's much harder to defend code than it is to attack it. And I think that's definitely true with AI. I mean, as I said, AI is almost a shortcut. And you said it yourself. You can just give AI a general description of Flappy Bird, and it can build the code, right?
That was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So think about the same thing. If an attacker can write a proof of concept in a matter of seconds by feeding it into ChatGPT and have it actually test it via different plugins, you can create sort of an AI agent that can go and basically penetration test on chain quite easily. And then all you have to do is kind of give it some general guidance, general direction. And it can even be almost like a fuzzing, like, you know, experience where you take a shotgun approach and you let it go wild on the chain and just see what it finds, right? So you can say like, oh, I think there, you know, there's this complex system that uses oracles or something. And I think there might be in this one liquidity pool an assumption being made, and I want to kind of challenge that. Let me tell that to ChatGPT, and it'll formulate a bunch of different potential attack chains, and it'll go and execute them, and it will verify if something happens, and it'll come back. That would take an attacker days, maybe weeks of research and planning, but ChatGPT could do it quite quickly. So it really just enables, it gives them probably a bigger Iron Man suit, really, to go and attack stuff.
That is insane. Yeah, so you got the 10X Lex Luthor is a real thing. I was afraid you were going to say that, but that's how it seemed to me, just sort of thinking about it. So you guys came up with this, as I understand it, at ETH Denver, I guess like a year ago or something like that. So tell us sort of the origin tale of, you know, who else is involved with this that you can talk about, and how'd you guys tell us the origin tale.
Yeah, so. You know, I was working at Apple last year when I went to ETH Denver, and I kind of tagged along with some friends, and I was kind of dipping my toes in the Web3 auditing space, you know, because I had started investing in different tokens. I would look at the smart contracts and get a little bit upset about the code that I was looking at and some of the security things that were glossed over. So claimed some bug bounties and then started to get really passionate about it. And when I was in ETH Denver, I met some guys, and I, you know, I was complaining to them basically when I was kind of talking about what I've been doing in the space that, you know, I'm trying to be a freelance auditor, but I'm finding it really difficult because I don't know the path forward. There's, you know, I had to market myself. There's a lot of tooling I don't know how to use. I don't know where to get started. And there's just a lot of friction points, right? You know, I didn't like a lot of that. And I was like, man, it would be so cool if I could just write a tool that would do all these things for me, that would just make my life so much easier as an auditor. And everything's just one click away instead of having to take a week to learn how to use a tool and configure it and have all this friction every time I go to use it. You know, I met some cool guys there, and we decided, well, you know, let's try to build it. Let's see what happens. So we started hacking away at it. Last year, built it for, I don't know, about 10 months, and then decided that this thing actually has some legs to it, and decided to fundraise. And, you know, we closed our pre-seed round pretty recently, and now we're full-time building it. So yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Well, congratulations on all that. I love what you're doing. I think it's great, and I think you're sober and rational about it. You're not. There's a lot of AI hype out there right now, especially on Twitter. I mean, it feels like AI is a meme coin for VCs now, right? It almost has that kind of level of crazy overhype. And while, you know, I'm astounded by what I see ChatGPT do, everybody is. I still feel like there's a lot of overly breathless commentary on it coming out of a lot of VCs right now. So thank you. I commend your sobriety. So Souvlaki, what's on your mind? You look like you're thinking about something. You got a question or a comment?
No, just a comment that I think it's really cool. I think the industry has a lot of bad actors in it, and it's nice to see someone that's actually building something that is the foundation for something that is meant for the good and that can help many, many projects. Because it's so often that you hear a protocol got exploited or a protocol, they locked funds, because they do stupid shit. It's nice that there's an automated tool that can help them not make some of those, I guess, more basic errors because they're too busy focused on the more complex things. So yeah, it's really cool. Excited to see what you're doing. If you don't mind me asking, how big is your team working on it?
We're about four people right now, and we're hiring two more. Yeah, so good solid team for a startup. And I'll say that our mission really is to make security more accessible, because that's really the core of why we started this business, is we saw all the pain points and really the unscalability with the kind of auditing landscape. I mean, everyone in the space knows audits cost $30,000-$50,000. You wait 6 months for them. It's a terrible experience. No one can access actual security without being an expert in it. And those experts are hard to find. So we're doing everything we can to kind of bridge that gap and make the space a little bit more healthy in terms of security. And hopefully, all those, meme coins and small projects that just completely die due to security flaws, hopefully that will go down. And we can kind of do everything we can to stop that from happening.
Yeah. So one last comment before we leave this topic. So the other thought that I've had recently is that whereas crypto tends to favor the edges of society, so the people, AI, I think, tends to favor centralized actors. And in fact, those that have access to the data sets for the training, right? Because I think right now everybody's just training their AI on whatever, and nobody's really thought oh my God, this is my copyright. You should be paying me to have access to this data. All of Twitter, all of LinkedIn, all of Quora, all of the code repositories, all of GitHub, right? These things, that's valuable training data. So I think very quickly, those sources of training data will shut off to certain people who are not paying, right? So the centralized actors will have the advantage in AI. And in fact, as the Iron Man suits get better and better, we may not get them. The centralized access may, reserve the right to have access to the super Iron Man suits to themselves. Do you see it the same way? Am I right about this? Or is there hope for little guy AI?
I'll say for security there in Web3, especially, there's a lot of public data that's nice to use, but you're right. It's an unavoidable problem that AI is basically a data scaling challenge, right? Whoever has the most data has the best AI. That's just how it works. I don't think there's really anything you can do to kind of get around that problem. For a lot of different domains, security especially. And it's kind of hard also to build up these AI products without that centralization, because you need sort of the incentive for a company to go and build it. And then they want to kind of keep their moat, right? They don't want to kind of just publish their data where anyone can build their AI. So I do think that is sort of the future, where maybe the AI is more of an open source thing, but the data sets that it plugs into and kind of the models that it that it uses is more proprietary. I hope that future is one where that data is more accessible. You know, if you could pay $50 a month or something, or I don't know, $10 a month to access a certain set of data, that's accessible to the everyday user, and that may be a cost we could live with. But if it's only like a business to business, you know, transaction, and you need hundreds of thousands of dollars to be able to, understand what's going on in Quora, for example, and to query that data with AI, then that's not a good future.
Totally agree. All right, moving us along here. So next topic, BRC20's brick Bitcoin, and Binance stops Bitcoin withdrawals twice as a result. So, you know, as Lenin once said, there are blocks where decades happen. So the BRC20 topic that we covered last week caused the transaction volume on Bitcoin to go absolutely through the roof. So, you know, you can see there's a whole bunch of unconfirmed transactions. I've still got unconfirmed transactions on the chain that they're coming up on about 3 or 4 days old. Actually, more like 5 or 6 days. And the fees, the good news that came out of this is that the fees for the miners there, I went and looked at the block explorers. Blocks were producing 4 to 5 Bitcoins in fees for the miners in addition to the block rewards, which that has never happened before. So the miners made out like bandits. This is fantastic for them. And the ordinal transactions themselves accounted for roughly 45% of all transactions on Bitcoin over the last week or so. The number of people who are trading ordinals on BRC20 just keeps accelerating. I mean, weirdly, these are not really large numbers, you know, 40,000 people, 50,000 people. You know, for most products, that's not very large, but in this universe, it has a pretty oversized effect. And weirdly, Michael Saylor came out in favor, like saying nice things about ordinals on Bitcoin and inscriptions. And I didn't mention BRC20s in particular, but he was very favorable in general about this new development of people developing new things on Bitcoin. I think he realizes that it adds a lot of value to the network. However, we did see, you know, regular people that were trying to do regular Bitcoin transactions could not do them for about a day and a half. The chain was just so congested. It was just like CryptoKitties on Ethereum back in the day. And that's now cooled off, thankfully. So, you know, there was sort of a madness for about a week and a half, and things have more or less returned to normal now. But we've now seen what this kind of new activity is going to do to Bitcoin. So, Mr. Souvlaki, let me pose the question to you first. This BRC20 madness and things like it, which we know there'll be more of them on Bitcoin, is this a good development for Bitcoin, or is this horrific and it should be blocked?
No, I don't. Like, I think if you ultimately believe in terms of what Bitcoin and decentralized networks and on-chain activity is supposed to represent, I don't think you can fight for freedoms like financial freedom, freedom of expression, freedom to do whatever you want with your money, but then go, oh no, but only if it doesn't break the network. I don't think like it needs to be one of those. It's similar to like the weekend in the UK where they had the King's coronation. They were like, oh, everyone's free to express their opinions on it. And then they arrested people that had signs up front that were against it. Like, and they're like, oh, you know, we arrested them because they were a bit annoying. It's just like, I don't think it works like it. But I do think it is quite interesting. I think it comes when I was thinking about it, like, I split the two out, like Bitcoin the token and Bitcoin the network. And if we think about Bitcoin the network in terms of how, when it was deployed and the technology that it operates on, and then I try to think about like throughout history, whether it's like the release of radio, the release of TV waves, the music, like when we went from the various forms of portable music. I cannot think of an example where the very first iteration, while it was the groundbreaking moment that started, like that shaped modern day society, they aren't the versions we use currently. And I think like that is, I don't think Bitcoin's network is much different to that. That is a very important piece of technology in terms of what it represents to the future. But I think like most things, like it's never like the first time we try something, it's never going to be perfect. And I think things like this are evidence of that. And I know people, like many, will try and fix what happened with the BRC20s and the network getting bricked, but I don't know how many can because of the limitations of the network itself.
Yeah, let's start to Joe. Joe, what do you think about all this? Was this is this bad for Bitcoin? Should we block these transactions or no? We should just let it go and see what happens.
I mean, at some point, Bitcoin needs some sort of traffic to maintain its security budget, right? As the block rewards minimize it, so to me, it seems almost like kind of a champagne problem. You know, you're getting a ton of traffic on a chain. That's kind of a weird thing to complain about. I think it is. I think the main complaint is how bursty it is right now. That has a lot to do with the hype and how things are just coming up. But I think that's kind of ephemeral, right? Like the things will smooth out and it will, in my mind, probably be a positive for Bitcoin in the future. Bitcoin definitely has a lot of problems with scaling and transaction speed, things like that. I think at its core foundation, it's pretty unshakable in terms of like the properties, like being digital gold, right? But you do really need something to kind of keep that alive. And I see these like cool projects, ordinals, NFTs on the chain, BRC tokens, being those things that can kind of keep Bitcoin going long term.
Yeah, I mean, I'm clearly a fan of it. I think you're right. I think Bitcoin is unique. It's still proof of work. Proof of work remains undefeated for security and store of value. In my mind, that's my opinion on that. I don't think they should change it. I think if they ripped out the proof of work, that would be the death of it. It would no longer be the unique thing that it is. I do think that this kind of new activity is really interesting. I don't think Bitcoin is meant for small transactions. You know, it's not meant for buying coffee. It's meant for moving big piles of gobbing cash around, you know, millions of dollars worth of stuff. So, you know, if that takes, you know, a couple hours to get through the transaction horde, so be it. That's sort of how I feel about it. And if there's all these other tokens and inscriptions and ordinals and, you know, sats names like domains and things on the chain, those are very powerful artifacts that have, because it's backed by the beefiest network and beefiest supercomputer on Earth, i.e. the Bitcoin mining network, it has unique value because of that backing. So I think this causes, and because I've been using Bitcoin itself like gas, like I've been spending sats to do things. I've never done that before with Bitcoin, right? I just sort of got Bitcoin, put it in my wallet, and that was that. And now I'm like spending sats to do things. And it's reinvigorated my personal interest in Bitcoin in a way that it's never been. It's only been engaged that way with Ethereum. And it's harder. It takes longer. But I kind of like it more because it's Bitcoin. It has a weird psychological effect. But that said, there's a lot of people who are totally not into this plan, right? So now we're seeing articles like this. Among Bitcoin developers, debate is raging over whether to censor BRC20s. And this week coming up in Miami is Bitcoin Miami. And without a doubt, we're going to see the laser eyes versus the wizard hats. So the people who believe that Bitcoin should never change and should be immutable and all this BRC20 stuff with these little people should go away. And then there's the wizard hats, which are the people who love this stuff like I do, who think that actually we should think about increasing. Maybe we should increase the block space. Let me ask you that question. Do you think block space should be increased? Souvlaki, you go first.
Well, it's kind of difficult because I don't know. And I don't know because we always talk about how like we want to replace the current financial system, right? If we think about how many billions of transactions take place every second across the globe, what does that do to a network like Bitcoin, right? There are 400 now, You don't mind now while you're busy like experimenting with the network and doing things, and like Mark, your excitement when you're talking about it is quite notable, and it's like you've unlocked this new utility for Bitcoin now that you're spending it like gas, and like that is like that is part of like almost the romanticism of using it, and like it puts you back in terms of like not you personally, like a person, like the whole point of why we're here. But the other point is like this is supposed to be the future to go somewhere better than whatever we're dealing with currently in society, in the financial systems. And like having a backlog of 400 and odd thousand transactions like would be way worse if you had to scale it to actual you were using it for like outside world things. And mm-hmm. would you then be okay waiting half an hour for your payment for your grocery confirmation to go through, or for anything really? And I think that is where it's difficult for me, because part of me says like idealistically I like what the network is and what it represents, and maybe you shouldn't increase the block space. But the other side is, if you wanted to become this future, right, like something needs to be done. I don't know what that is, but like as it is now, it will never get the adoption that we keep talking about the industry getting.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a lot of people in the comments bringing up Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin, you know, Satoshi Vision, the Craig Wright thing, and how, you know, both of those systems have increased the block space. I think BSV allows for infinite block sizes depending on demand, and which is kind of an interesting way to approach it. They're like, we've already solved this problem. And then there's the Lightning crowd, which are, you know, basically saying Lightning solves all this. All you have to do is get mass adoption of Lightning. And then you have the layer twos like Bitcoin Libre and Stacks, which are now preaching that, you know, they are going to be able to wrap ordinals and, you know, basically come over to their chain, and you can do all this stuff sub-second, almost free gas. And these are all interesting. I mean, I think these are all viable approaches potentially. Joe, what's on your mind with respect to these potential solutions?
I think you kind of nailed it earlier with the intent of Bitcoin being kind of the settlement layer for large sums of cash. And I think I kind of agree with that. It's facing a similar problem to Ethereum, but of course Ethereum had the you know, ability to have layer twos on top of it to address the scaling problem. So really it's the question now is, how do we scale Bitcoin? I don't think just increasing the block size is going to be enough for global adoption. I think it has to be a different type of solution than what we have on the table now. I kind of like the immutability of Bitcoin, and I'm kind of in the camp of let's leave it where it is. You know, pick one camp or the other. Either we're going to make changes to Bitcoin and it's going to be an evolving blockchain just like Ethereum, or it's set in stone, it's ossified, let's not touch it. And I kind of, I'm in that second camp, I would say.
Okay. Very good. So I didn't really get an opinion from you guys on Lightning. There's an awful lot of voices around me saying that Lightning is going to solve all of these things. Souvlaki, let me throw it to you. Do you know much about Lightning and how that works? And do you think it solves this?
No, I don't. But I know a lot about, like, I've heard that story before about, like, everyone's going to solve something, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's successful or not, I do not know. Like, I haven't used it myself, so I cannot, like, I cannot say whether, like, what my experience is like. So I don't know, Mark.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is based on just what I've heard from other folks. The way Lightning works is that people set up nodes, and the nodes are filled up with Bitcoin. And the nodes then talk to one another about transactions. And so the nodes effectively act like banks, sort of. So, you know, if I basically send a transaction to you through another node, the other node actually is where you can get your Bitcoin out of that node, but it comes out of like their pile. So each node has like a pile that they manage, and they all agree to collectively work together to either take in or push out Bitcoin. And so the transactions don't actually move over the Bitcoin network. They're just sort of accounted throughout the nodes, right? Which, and the nodes are coming up and going up and down all the time. So if a node disappears with your Bitcoin in it, like you can't get your Bitcoin out of it, right? So you know, if there's an FTX node, right, let's just say, and it suddenly vanishes, you're shit out of luck. That's the way I understand it. Is that, Joe, do you know much about this?
I probably know about as much as you. I do know that it's kind of almost this social settlement layer on top of Bitcoin. There is some layer of trust and kind of incentive alignment using deposits and making sure people are you know, operating as they should be. For me, I think that it's an okay solution, but it's definitely not ideal. There's definitely some limitations with it, with what you can do. But yeah, I don't know enough to like really dissect it.
Okay. Well, with that, then we will push along to our next topic. And that topic is Wyoming is trying to create its own stablecoin. And the way they're describing it is it's collateralized fully by fiat money in a bank. So basically like a Tether kind of thing. So kind of like a Wyoming Tether or a Wyther, if you will. And you know, the thinking behind this in their minds, well, first of all, Wyoming, a lot of people tend to discount Wyoming. They're like, nah, Wyoming, who cares? It's not New York. But Wyoming's kind of badass. They invented the LLC. It started there, right? So they actually are pretty good innovators at sort of wild new ideas, both in terms of corporate structure and now, of course, cryptocurrency. Also in Wyoming is a company called M-Shift. And they were founded in 1999. And basically, this company is a mobile banking provider. So when you interact with your bank, either online or on your phone, 60% of the time, you're actually using M-Shift under the hood. So it's not really Bank of America. It's M-Shift. And then M-Shift is, you know, selling their services to Bank of America. And it's white labeled Bank of America. You don't know you're using M-Shift, but you are. And in 2018, this M-Shift network handled 4.8 trillion transactions. So they, you know, with 60% market share, they've seen how, you know, handling stable or handling fiat currency is actually, you know, pretty profitable. But their complaints are that the credit card fees are too high, the speeds are too slow, and a stable coin would fix this. So they are proceeding with trying to figure out how to do this at the state level. And they're saying some very interesting things. They're basically right now creating legislation, but also asking the federal government for guidance on whether this is possible or not. And this is one of the more interesting comments that came out of them. They say if the federal government says that it's legally impossible, if they actually provide some things in terms of feedback, which is basically like a negative response, it doesn't necessarily mean that even if they determine no, that wouldn't necessarily be our ultimate advice. So in other words, if the federal government tells them no, the information they glean from that may in fact inform how they decide to go about actually creating the stablecoin anyway. So Wyoming seems pretty, you know, hell-bent on this. Souvlaki, what do you think? Can this succeed or is this just insane?
I don't know. I really don't know. You said Tether is backed one for one with the dollar. Actually, just on the 30 March report, there's actually Tether is backed. There's $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin that backs Tether as of 31 March. And it's not publicly known. Like they kind of slipped it onto their balance sheet in Q1. But anyways, regarding this, I wonder if a state issuing its own stable coin, let's say Wyoming does it and it becomes super successful, and then that, then by successful I mean it rolls out that anywhere in Wyoming you can now use the stable coin to purchase, right? And that's how they, that is what stimulates the economy, is this Wyoming stable coin. And then let's say Texas gets a bit jealous because they see the additional GDP that as the stable coin has brought them, and they do their own one. And you have like 4, 5, maybe 6 states that bring it, and these things grow at scale. Does that possibly destabilize the dollar? Because now within the US, you have your own states that are now you're basically fractionalizing the liquidity. And I don't know what that means, because it's not like the US economy or the dollar itself is really that strong, right? It's at its weakest. They were talking, like, there's a tweets thread that Eleanor Terrett, who was on the show a few weeks ago, put out, that they are saying that they're going to breach the US is going to breach its debt ceiling by possibly the sooner as the 1st of June. So it is, the economy is quite fragile. And by bringing competition in a house seems a bit batshit crazy. However, like,
is this really competition though, Souvlaki? I mean, it is the dollar. It's not like a competing currency.
Well, it depends, right? That it could be a competing, if you look at the money flow within Wyoming, if that is replaced, like 60% with this new stable coin, right? And taxes and everything is now taking place in the stable coin. How long do you think their loyalty will lie with keeping it only as a dollar backed stable coin, firstly, and then scale that out to other states? I think on its own, I think it doesn't cause too much of a damage in that sense. But mm-hmm. if you have 5, 6, 7 states that now replace the day-to-day transaction, 60% plus, no longer USD, with their own stablecoin. So I'm not saying Wyoming stablecoin in 5 states. I'm talking about Wyoming stablecoin in their state, Texas stablecoin in their state, Ohio stablecoin in their state. Now you have, so how does that all interact? You start breaking out, and then you become almost independent economic systems within the US. And that's why I say, I don't know what it does to the broader US economy, because you're traveling. What would you rather hold? Would you rather hold US dollar? Or would you rather hold Wyoming stablecoin, especially when you're going into Wyoming? So like it brings these interesting discussions, which it then starts. I do think it's competition, because the US government wants as many people transacting in US dollars on a daily basis.
But they these are US dollars. This is what I've, so yeah, Souvlaki. I mean, it's not like these, it's not like the, you know, 1800s wildcat banking days when like Texas was issuing its own currency, its own script, right? And, you know, Minneapolis was issuing its own, like, Minnesota's issuing its own currency, right? These are all dollars. So, and there'd be ostensibly something like a curve where someone could go trade Tether for USDC. You could trade Wyoming stable for Texas stable, right? Like, it's still dollars. You don't seem to think so though.
I think it's a bit more nuanced than that, in a sense that, you know, why not then just a federal stable coin, right? Why would they push for their own stable coin? If it is 100% the same thing, why are they pushing their own stable coin when they know that CBDCs is on the White House's agenda, and they know that the Fed is going to try and push that through in the short to medium term?
I think that's why, because I trust Wyoming more than I trust the federal government of the United States, honestly. But
that's fine. So from a stable, but why is that different from when from using US dollars, right? So in terms of legal tender throughout the country, right, wouldn't you think, in terms of a governing body, they would want one stable coin, the federal stable coin, used throughout the US, as opposed to having states having their own version of it? Mm-hmm. That is not the federal version. So now you have a state stable coin, let's say you have 4 or 5, and a federal stable coin in a few years time. Like, yes, you can trade them on a curve, but that doesn't, it creates unnecessary friction, right? Why not just one federal stable coin if that is the goal?
Unless, to rule them all, perhaps?
CBDC
to rule them all. So we've left Joe out of this discussion. Sorry, Joe, what do you think about all this? Are we insane, or what do you think?
I think Souvlaki has a lot of good points. I mean, the value of a dollar is based on the demand of the dollar, right? Like, if instead of using actual dollars, people are using this kind of synthetic of dollars, then there's less, you know, cash flow, thus less demand, right? And so it's kind of weird to peg a coin to the very thing it's trying to replace. The same criticism goes with the CBDC as well. Like, I don't know exactly how we're going to handle that, but it's a very interesting problem of what happens to the value of the fiat, which we're pegging to. I guess I don't really know what's going to happen there, but it's a little spooky to me. But I will say, for Wyoming issuing their own stablecoin, it really just seems like just the same thing like Circle or Tether, right? It's just that it's a state doing it. So I don't really see a whole lot of immediate effects from it. I'm not sure I really see the use case. Like, who really wants to use this when there's fiat available and, you know, it's really kind of tied to one specific state? So I guess I'm not really sure who this is for, but I think it's actually a good start to see government taking these kind of baby steps into crypto. So I'm positive on the news, but I'm skeptical about the efficacy of what they're doing.
Well, I think, sorry, go ahead, Suvlaki.
I actually had a question for you. Wyoming as a state, who does it generally align with, Republicans or Democrats?
It's more Republican, but it tends to be more libertarian than anything.
So we've seen quite often that Republicans are pushing for, well, let's call it, they are calling out the SEC while the Democrats are supporting the SEC. Do you think a state like Wyoming doing something like this is the first part of states actually getting fed up with this lack of regulatory clarity? That if they just sorted the shit out at the top of the house, this doesn't happen because you have this, like, CBDC or regulation that just does everything, where perhaps this is them saying, well, you guys can't decide what's going to happen, so we're going to try our own thing.
Well, I mean, I do think they see this as a real business. They see it as a massive, you know, you brought up Tether's report. They reported that they made like $1.4 billion in Q1 of this year, which is more than BlackRock made in Q1 of this year. So incredibly profitable.
Yeah, right? But like, what happened in Q1, right? They 1.4 billion. That's because they minted like a few more tethers because of what happened at Circle, right? Like Silicon Valley Bank, Tether, Circle's depegging. That all happened in Q1. That all happened mid March, right? And that's what drove a lot of the growth in Tether's market cap and the revenues. But yeah, I hear you. I was just thinking like perhaps this is, well, maybe I'm kind of hoping that this is part of like friction within the states to force decision at a federal level. Like,
oh, I agree. Look, Wyoming has got big balls on it. And I know that they're not happy with the federal government in multiple dimensions, certainly not with respect to crypto. And, as you brought up, Tether, USDC, momentarily depegged because it was so deeply entwined with Silicon Valley Bank, but we had Tether to run to. So that's a great example of, it's good to have multiple stable coins, right? Tether at that moment looked like the safer option, which I don't think there was on anybody's bingo card, but for, you know, a good couple of weeks there, that looked like the better option by far. And, you know, you asked me, I like the Wyoming stable coin because even though I know what the state of Wyoming can brick my Wyoming stable coins, I trust that they will share my American values of free speech to a greater degree than the federal government of the United States of America, and will at least attempt not to brick me if I protest or if I tweet something that the federal government doesn't like. So in that respect, I think it's a better brand of stable coin. So
yeah, makes sense. Like, that makes sense. And I mean, it can evolve into something quite fascinating, and it's good to see it. Like, it's good to see someone stand up, and yeah, like you said, big balls.
Yes. Okay. Well, we're coming up on the hour, and you know we like to keep the show at an hour these days. So I'm going to wrap things up here. Joe Van Loon, sorry about that. Thank you so much from Auditware for coming on the show. Any last words of wisdom for the kids?
Of course, happy to be here. One thing I want to say to everyone in the building in the crypto space is to hire a security person. Don't kind of neglect your security needs, and make sure you take care of your OPSEC.
Totally agree. Mr. Souvlaki, any parting words?
It's great to be here again. Thank you to everyone that's commenting in the live chat. It was fun to read along, and thanks for having me again, Mark.
Yeah, it was great to have you, Souvlaki. Thank you so much. My name is Mark Jeffrey. This has been Across the Chains. That's it. We'll see you next time.